From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 8th day of October, 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office for the afternoon, so no update of the commodity markets. However, we will hear from agricultural economist Scott Irwin about renewable diesel and the biofuels policies the Trump administration has been putting forward. And then we'll turn our attention to weeds with Aaron Hager, weed scientist at the University of Illinois. As you are making your way through harvest, I know you're paying attention to what weeds are in your fields and making a plan for next year. Aaron has some thoughts on what might and might not work going forward. Oh, and I'll remind you that you should visit our website too at WILLAG.org. It's now updated with information on the Farm Assets Conference. That's coming up on the 12th day of December. It's a Friday. You don't want to miss it in Bloomington, Illinois. You can find a partial list of the details, more information on our website, and a way to register at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You know, the second Trump administration's biofuels policy is expected to be more favorable to agriculture and to biofuels compared to the first administration. Recent policy changes, including aggressive RFS mandates, a revised 45Z tax credit, and a ruling on small refinery exemptions, are bullish for biofuels and feedstocks. These changes, coupled with a potential reallocation of RIN obligations, could lead to significant price increases in the biofuels and feedstock sectors. As it happens, one of the nation's leading experts in this area is located right here on campus, Scott Irwin, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois. I asked him first to lay out the biofuels sector as it stands today.
Big picture first.
Yes.
Was second Trump administration, what was going to be their policy bias, pro-ag or pro-big oil in the second administration? That's the big question that hung over everything. In the first Trump administration, decidedly pro-big oil. So that was the first question everyone's was wondering about. And the answer to that is basically a complete reversal in Trump 2.0 compared to Trump 1.0. Big oil was in the driver's seat firmly in the first Trump administration. All the signs now are that it's been a 180, and now ag is in the driver's seat, or ag and biofuels, however you want to say it.
If agriculture gets an MFP payment, I suppose that will be a real telltale sign that ag's going to stay in the... I know there's a differentiation, but I feel like that tells us that ag, given the amount of tariffs that are going on across all kinds of different industries...
Although I would still say it's still a change in kind, because in the first Trump administration, there were large trade payments.
Right.
But biofuels policy clearly went in the direction of the interests of the oil industry. This time, probably we're going to get both.
Maybe, and if we don't get both, and we only get the RVO, I'm trying to suggest that it may have swapped positions. But we'll see. That's a policy issue yet to come.
We do have well-defined data points now on biofuels that we can talk about.
Tell me about them.
So the first one was last June, the new Trump administration, EPA, which is responsible for setting the RFS mandates, came out with their first major rulemaking, and it was for setting what are called the RVOs, or the mandates, for 2026 and 2027. So that was point number one. And wow, they surprised everyone with how aggressive they set the mandate levels and some of the trade restricting rules that were new in that rulemaking.
Used cooking oil not being able to come in and be used in renewable diesel, for instance.
Well, that's a different policy. What they did in the RFS rulemaking specifically was ruled to comply with the mandates. Obligated parties, which are the refiners and importers, have to turn in something called RIN credits. And they proposed in June that if you are complying through an imported biofuel or a domestically produced biofuel from imported feedstock, like used cooking oil from China, you only get half a RIN. I mean, 50% of if you use domestic feedstocks and compared, you get twice as much RIN revenue if you use domestic biofuels made from domestic feedstocks. That is a, if that survives to the final rulemaking, which I think it will, that's a very bullish development in terms of biofuels and feedstock markets right there.
Can you convert that to bushels in bullish development, or?
Oh, I haven't really spent much time doing that. It's very hard to do that.
Right.
Okay. Say that. But it certainly increases, particularly the demand for soybean oil, and a lot of discussion about where that's headed. So that's data point number one. Data point number two was in the Big Beautiful Bill, a revised tax credit for biofuels. So the brief history there is we had a biodiesel, $1 a gallon biodiesel tax credit for a long time. 2022, in the IRA bill under the Biden administration, that was converted to something called 45Z, with the level of the credit keyed to carbon intensity scores. So that's what happened there. In the BBB, there were a number of features of the new 45Z that was passed under the Biden administration that ag was very upset about. And they successfully, dramatically changed the rules for the 45Z tax credit in the BBB that was passed in July. For example, now almost every corn ethanol plant in the United States is going to probably be eligible for a 10 to 15 cent tax credit, at least, under that bill. And they had not been getting anything since 2011. And, you know, there's a variety of changes there, but the big one was that told you ag was in control was that they eliminated in the carbon scoring something called ILUC, ILUC, or indirect land use charges. Those went away and really puts plant-based vegetable oils in the biofuels tax credit world on an even footing with the things like used cooking oil, tallow, and animal-based fats and grease. And so that's data point number two. That was a bullish development. Data point number three is something that was released last Friday called an SRE ruling, small refinery exemptions. And without getting into all the gory details, there's a way that small refineries can petition to be exempted from the obligations. In the first Trump administration, these were used as a backdoor means of cutting the mandates. That's all you need to know. And so everybody's wondering, huge uncertainty for legal and political reasons. There was this incredible backlog of these SRE petitions going all the way back to 2016. You know, billions and billions and billions of gallons of biofuels in essence, demand was in essence at stake. And so they released their rulemaking. And on net, it's got a lot of dimensions to it, very bullish. And there's really only one more domino to fall, in my opinion, before we have, at least in the biofuels, in especially renewable diesel and FAME, a pretty explosive situation. And that's a technical issue called reallocation. So the idea is if you award an exemption from the RFS mandates to these small refiners, what happens? Under the first Trump administration, they in essence just subtracted from the mandates. Reallocation is just transferring the obligation, the gallons from the small to the larger refiners. That decision is still outstanding. But the press release last Friday, everything I'm picking up from talking to people in D.C. is that it's going to be something in the ballpark near full reallocation. And
which means all the SREs that are forgiven, all those billions and billions of gallons, get transferred and must be absorbed by the large refineries.
In the future.
In the future.
Yes. And now, they did a very cute trick that's going to clearly end up in court. For the old 2016 through 2022 SRE petitions, which there were, by my estimation, at least 10 billion gallons of those things were potentially in play. They awarded them all, but gave them back in return their old RINs, which are worthless. Oh, the small refiners' heads were exploding. And they're going to take that to court immediately. And so this whole story's not over, but that'll play out in the courts years and years into the future. So, what the EPA did under Trump is they didn't give out as many. Most of what they gave out were worthless. And so there's maybe around 3 billion gallons of worth of RINs that are at play in reallocation. And I think, I don't know what the number will be, but it'll be at least $2.5 billion likely to be reallocated.
A clarification point for me, because sometimes when we talk about RINs and them being reallocated, these are already produced gallons, already used gallons. But if they're reallocated and pushed forward, are these gallons that the large refiners are now obligated to produce going forward, and that's why we're bullish?
Yes. Well, it's a combination, Todd. Number one, I'm assuming that the final mandate levels will be about what was released in June. I think that's not hopefully a very controversial position. They're high. And there's this half RIN part of that. So they're high. And they're going to add on top of that some SRE reallocation. And then you've got restrictions on imported feedstocks that were a part of 45Z as well. And I will use the E word. This is setting up to be explosive price action in the first part of 2026 in RINs, biofuels, and some feedstock markets.
Now, usually when we're talking about this, we're thinking about corn and ethanol, but in this case, you're talking about FAME,
yes,
or soybeans and biodiesel,
yes,
not renewable diesel, but
both will highly benefit from this.
It was Scott Irwin, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We'll have an update from Scott, by the way, during the Farm Assets Conference coming up on the 12th day of December in Bloomington, Illinois. It looks like it should be a fantastic day. You can see the agenda online now at our website at willag.org, willag.org, and soon enough at the FarmDoc daily website as well. The Farm Assets Conference, sponsored by University of Illinois Extension and the FarmDoc team. Check it out. All the details online now at willag.org and a registration link as well. I hope to see you on the 12th day of December. It's a Friday in Bloomington, Illinois. Up next, you know, weed control remains a problem in farm fields across the Corn Belt. Much of this has to do with the development of resistance to the chemistries now available. University of Illinois weed scientist Aaron Hager has more on the issues and what to expect.
Pretty much, we'll see one or two new active ingredients coming probably next year. But they'll be new to us, but actually these are fairly old active ingredients from Europe. Difluphenican is one active ingredient that Bayer Crop Science will bring into the marketplace. The original concept from the company several years ago was to bring it only as a premixed product with one or two different other active ingredients. But apparently that decision now has been changed and it will be straight difluphenican. It can be fairly active on the amaranthus complex, but again, by itself, like so many other examples that we've looked at now for close to 30 years, there's very, very few active ingredients, especially in the pre-emergence marketplace, that'll take us all the way from planting through the post-application timing.
Is this a corn or a soybean herbicide?
It'll actually be both. I don't know, not really for sure what the push will be the first year. It'll be kind of a limited launch, I think, in 26, but more full scale, I'm sure, launch there on more broad acres and starting about 2027.
If you're in a limited, if you have the ability and you're a producer in the limited launch area, would you decide to make that choice?
It will be another option for farmers. It's not the only option that they have. Several years ago, we started to take another look or a fresh look at metribuzin in soybean, simply because that is an active ingredient that allows us to exploit one of the very few weaknesses of the resistance complex that we see in our water hemp populations here in Illinois. And that is the fact that when we see resistance to the photosystem 2 inhibitors or the PS2 inhibitors, that type of resistance is almost always non-target site. So in other words, it's a metabolic type of resistance. And by that, we mean the target site remains in a sensitive formation, but yet the plant is actively able to metabolize the herbicides before it causes any sort of detrimental effect. So when you have metabolic triazine resistance, that would render things like atrazine and Princep ineffective, but metribuzin, being an asymmetrical triazine, still remains effective. But many people here, you almost have to have a little bit of gray hair to remember how we used to use metribuzin in soybean here in Illinois back in the 70s and 80s. But what we have found is that it can still be one of the most effective soil residual herbicides that we have now on multiple resistant populations. But just like every other product, we have to make sure that we get the application right, correct, based on the soil texture for the individual field that we're going to be applying it to.
Based on soil texture?
Soil texture and organic matter. Very important. A lot of the most recent use, and by recent use, we'll say within the last 20 to 25 years, would be about 5 ounces or 5 1/3 ounces of a 75 DF equivalent product. And that's simply on the dark prairie soils. It's simply not enough. We need to make sure that we've got those application rates where they need to be. The work that we have done primarily in Champaign County would suggest if we're running something like a 75 DF formulated product, we should be looking at about 8 to 10 ounces on most of the fields. And we, in our work that we actually put this on a population resistant to herbicides from 6 different classes, once we hit that 10-ounce rate at 6 weeks after planting, we were still greater than 90% water hemp control.
Is this what you suggest producers do for next season?
Again, it's another option that we can, the more tactics that we can bring to bear on these populations, the better off in the long run we're going to be, because, we really haven't changed the story now for almost 30 years, but we cannot chemically solve this problem that we have with water hemp. It's not going to work. You know, we've gone through an era where, when I started here 32 years ago, some of the ALS inhibitors, things like Pursuit and Classic and Pinnacle, pretty much had the majority of the soybean market, but because resistance evolved primarily in water hemp, we do not see the extensive use of that chemistry. We had to find something else in soybean. That turned into the diphenyl ethers, things like the Flexstars and the Cobras. We have widespread resistance to that. About the time that was happening, along came 1996, in the first year of the glyphosate of the Roundup Ready technology. And a lot of people looked at the weed science community and said, we don't need you anymore. Glyphosate or Roundup is going to be all that we're going to need. Well, history has shown us again that this species has adapted to that. So we now have, you know, I can remember a time almost 30 years ago when our group published a paper that showed two-way resistance in a water hemp population. And that was just, you know, that was news at the time. Now we're up to six in one population. And eventually we'll find seven, and eventually we'll get to eight.
So this fall, when producers are in the combines, what do they need to pay attention to?
Yeah, we always say the combine is really the last scouting opportunity, weed science scouting opportunity for a growing season. So obviously you know what your program was, and that's your last real look to see, okay, how effective was it? If we see that we've got clean fields, what did we do right? Go back, look at the rates, look at the rainfall application, look at the parameters that you had on your post-application. If it worked that well, I wouldn't recommend changing a whole awful lot if you don't have any surviving weeds. If you have surviving weeds, that's a different ball game. Why did they survive? Are we talking about the continued evolution of resistance? Are you talking about something like water hemp, maybe even giant ragweed in northern Illinois that simply emerged after that herbicide had dissipated from the soil? What sort of adjustment do you need to do? Because ultimately, and we've tried to convince this message now for years, you know, the way that you actually win, so to speak, against, you know, an amaranthus population resistant to herbicides from six or seven different classes is not just to open up a new jug. That's not going to work indefinitely. The weakness, of course, is the fact the seeds do not remain viable indefinitely in the seed bank. So doing whatever it is that you can do to try to limit seed production, if you can do that for three or four consecutive years, it's not uncommon to see the water hemp populations in a field dramatically decline very, very quickly. That's how you stay in front of it. That's how you get back in front of it.
Anything we didn't talk about that you think people should know about?
No, I mean, there's always an opportunity, I think, in the fall of the year after you do that scouting operation, if you see things like a lot of winter annual species emerging, if you've got the time to do that, you know, perhaps something like a fall application would be something that could be fairly beneficial for you, because generally speaking, the winter annuals are always going to be more sensitive in the fall of the year than they are the following spring after they've overwintered and resumed growth.
Aaron Hager is a weed scientist based on the campus here at the University of Illinois. I spoke with him about herbicides and new chemistries that might be introduced sooner rather than later. You've been listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report on this Wednesday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.